This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com. Tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to After the Bell. I am still Corey Graves. Crown Jewel is in the books. We've got a brand new King of the Ring and the first ever winner of the Queen's Crown Tournament, which is how we arrived here today, taking a look back to the past, of course, helping me navigate this journey into how we got here, the Barney Rubble to my Fred Flintstone. The voice of NXT 2.0, Vic Joseph. Vic, what's the word?
Yabba dabba do. I love the fact that we're going over King of the Ring. It's one of my favorite events. It was one of my favorite events as a kid when it came to WWE programming. So I'm really stoked to talk about this one in particular because it was the first time me and a group of my friends actually ordered a WWE pay-per-view.
Well, before we dive in too deep to King of the Ring 1995, if you haven't already seen it or watched it recently, pull it up, WWE Network on Peacock, King of the Ring 1995. It is what we are talking about, what we are reliving this week on After the Bell. But before we get to the fun part, Vic, the streak is over.
Yes, it apparently is.
Three weeks in a row, I was able to bring my best self to the podcast in my comfy satin pajamas. But alas, full disclosure, I had to go halfway across the earth this week. My satin pajamas are at the dry cleaners, man.
Did you wear this on the plane? Fly halfway around the world in your satin pajamas?
Listen, there were a lot of people on the plane. Just ask. You'll find out the answer for yourself. I may have been at my best at about 35,000 feet in the air, feeling comfy AF. But alas, this week, back to the street clothes. The satin pajamas are coming back. I'm still making it a thing, but we're not here to talk about comfortable sleepwear. We're reliving King of the Ring 1995. As always, when we do these sort of fun deep dives, our producers, Alex and Dan, have joined the fun. Alex, how are you this morning?
I'm great, guys. I, you know, also missed the satin pajama menu or memo, but I wouldn't have any to wear anyway, so...
Well, there is quite the menu at Graves' house, actually.
So I have heard that.
I'm working on building out the menu. I've only got a couple of options right now. I need more. Christmas is right around the corner. So anyone that needs to figure out what to get me, obnoxious satin pajamas are on the menu. Dan Reichert, what's the good word this morning?
Good word is there's no shame in being comfortable on a flight. I have worn many gym shorts, potentially even some hungover pajama pants on flights. You got to be comfortable there. You can do slippers. Back when before I had the TSA pre-check and you got to take your shoes off, you can wear some slippers or sandals. Just take those off real quick. Just be comfy. It's a flight. It's a pain.
I think there's a line that can't be crossed. I see people walking through airports, like you just mentioned, in pajama pants.
Like a bum.
Oftentimes carrying pillows. Have a little bit of pride in yourself.
Oh, no. I understand. Sleep mask. Give me the sleep mask. Give me the headphones. Listen, just comfy as hell.
A sweatsuit is acceptable, but have a little couth. You know, you are in some of the busiest places in the world, these massive airports. There are many, many people. Just take a little pride in yourself, man. I mean, there once upon a time, if you watch any old TV shows or actually probably predating all of our time, people used to get dressed up to fly.
Like you would put on a suit. Like suits and ties. Yeah,
that was like a social activity. And then people like Dan ruined it for all of us. So
comfort above all else.
Feet need to be covered on airlines. I don't want to see toenails.
I'm not barefoot. No.
Well, you just said slippers and sandals.
Slippers. The ones where it covers your feet. They're like nice winter ones where you tuck them in there and it's nice.
And then on a long flight, Dan, the majority of Americans will take them off because it's easy to do and sit there with their nasty feet.
I don't do that. No, I'm a respectful airline.
Feet covered.
I don't know what kind of airline you've been flying, Vic, but that's not acceptable.
Oh, it happens. Not acceptable.
This conversation is oddly apropos for this event, because there was indeed a Kiss My Foot match at King of the Ring 1995.
Oh, there sure was. Some would argue it was the headliner, maybe the highest profile matchup of the entire night. Bret Hart, Jerry the King Lawler, the infamous Kiss My Foot match. We'll get there as the show progresses, but let's start at the very top. The date was June 25th, 1995. We are in the Spectrum, the historic Spectrum in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And we are opened at the top of the King of the Ring event by several familiar faces and one not too familiar. Vince McMahon is one of your commentators, the other being Doc Hendricks, known to most as Michael P.S. Hayes. And the next face we see, Stephanie Wyand. What a blast from the past this was, guys. I couldn't for $1 billion have named her or even thought about her. But the minute I saw her face on my television, I went, oh, I remember Stephanie Wyand.
Well, it's funny we talk about her, because when Todd Pettengill came back for NXT's In Your House in June, we were going to have the backstage interviewers dressed as Stephanie and kind of be like a little presence to Todd Pettengill throughout the show, because he enjoys talking about her, because it was so odd. She came out of a Christmas present, if you guys remember, when she debuted. It was a Christmas present to Todd Pettengill on whatever the Saturday morning show was at the time.
I don't recall that at all. Mania. It might have been Mania, though.
Yeah,
I
remember Mania. Todd Pettengill she filled in for Savage. Savage used to co-host it with Pettengill. And I remember, like, okay, that's going to be really big shoes to fill. And then Stephanie Wyand just to fill in for Randy Savage, which is a very night and day difference.
At what point did that show turn into Livewire? Because I remember that.
Wasn't Livewire Sunday? I thought Saturday was Mania, Sunday was Livewire.
Oh, you might be right, Dan. You might be right there. But I remember Livewire very, very vividly.
That's the story of old Stephanie, who didn't last very long, if you want to look up her Wikipedia.
Old familiar face to welcome us to the nostalgia trip of King of the Ring 1995. Now, Alex, in doing so, doing your research, as you do so well on behalf of the ATB crew, you came across a few less than favorable reviews of King of the Ring 1995 from the fans' perspective.
So this event is largely considered by the fans of in the WWE universe to be one of the least favorable pay-per-views in the history of, that the company has produced. And as we go through this today on this episode, you're going to understand why. There were some bright spots and certainly some historical significance to this event, however. And that takes me back to what you mentioned earlier, Graves, the Philadelphia Spectrum, the home of the Broad Street Bullies back in the 70s. This building was basically, if you would say the most important building to the history of the WWE was Madison Square Garden, I would say the Spectrum was either number two or even 1A. I mean, they were running the Spectrum back all the way to 1974. King of the Ring 1995 was the last televised event ever from the Spectrum. There were a couple house shows that came after that into 1996, but in 96 is when Ed Snyder, the chairman of the Flyers, opened the new building right next door, which was at the time known as the Core State Center. Now it's known as the Wells Fargo Center. And that's when the WWE started running that building. WCW would take over the Spectrum after that, run for a few more years until the Spectrum was eventually demolished in 2009. So that is why this event is historical. The Spectrum meant a ton to the Northeast area for the WWE, and this was one of the last events they ever ran there.
That was the most passionate description of a wrestling venue I think I have ever heard in
my life. Well, I am from Philadelphia, Graves, so this kind of means a little bit to me. So,
I touch it. It hits him in the heart.
It Graves. Does. It hits me in the heart, even though this event didn't live up to what the Spectrum really meant to the company.
Well, WWE leaned in heavily to the Philadelphia theme for the night. It felt like every other sentence out of Mr. McMahon's mouth on commentary involved the one and only Rocky Balboa. But the theme pertaining to Rocky Balboa was involving a certain Puerto Rican superstar at the time, one Savio Vega, who would kick off the night, at least on Peacock, courtesy of Coliseum Home Video, in a match that took place earlier in the night on the, I guess nowadays we would call it a kickoff show, but remember in the days of cable when you had to call an order, you had 30 minutes, there was a little countdown in the corner and they'd have a match on for you. Basically the same concept as we use modern day kickoff shows. But the first match of the tournament actually took place on that, IRS versus Savio Vega, basically WWE's answer to Rocky Balboa.
I love Vince doing the Rocky comparisons, because at one point he says, like, oh, it's reminiscent of Rocky Balboa's antics. And it's like, antics? He's not Bugs Bunny. He's Rocky Balboa. Antics? He's not doing pranks and, like, pantsing Apollo.
Savio Vega, I remember this very, you know, specifically with my buddies. We became huge Savio Vega fans. So they did their job that night in hooking us, because we're like, oh, this is the guy. I wanted Shawn Michaels to win, but I was like, oh man, Savio Vega, this is so cool. He's being able to step up and fill in, because of course Razor Ramon, who was in the tournament, had to be taken out of the tournament for an injury to the ribs. I don't know if that was real or part of a story, but nonetheless, he was injured. So Savio Vega fills in, defeats IRS, obviously, in this matchup to get into the quote unquote tournament and pay-per-view proper, as we call it in the office, quote unquote.
But the table has now been set. Savio Vega has got to run the table. He's got to win three matches in a matter of hours, a task so monumental, it's got to be impossible, right?
It's got to be. That's what hooked us. We're like, this guy's going to do it. This is it. This is going to be history. I mean,
well, and if you include this qualifying match that happened before the pay-per-view kicked off, it's actually four matches.
That's true. That is true. And I
which is pretty wild.
I should have known better, because every time Savio was on the screen, that was driven home. It was an effective story. It painted Savio as an underdog, and Savio's reward for defeating Irwin R. Scheister, a date with Yokozuna.
Bum, bum, bum. No easy task to open the night.
When Yoko came out, they said something about, like, Jim Cornette as the representation of Mr. Fuji. I'm trying to remember storyline-wise what was going on then. Like, was Fuji out for a bit? Was he managing someone else? Like, why was Cornette announced that way?
I remember Owen and Yoko as tag champs, which was during this time frame, and I always remember Cornette. I remember Yoko individually with Fuji, but I don't recall the storyline as to why Cornette was with Yoko and Owen Hart.
Before the pay-per-view actually got started, we actually had a very nice introduction to the city of Philadelphia, courtesy of something I completely forgot existed, which was the WWE blimp.
The WWE blimp, yeah. The Stridex airship. Was it Stridex? I can't remember.
Stridex later on, like Attitude Era was Stridex.
Yes, but there was actually two vessels on this pay-per-view. There was the outdoor blimp that was hovering over the city of Philadelphia in the Spectrum, and then there was the indoor Stridex blimp in the arena. I don't, what was up with the aircrafts on in 1990?
I did notice when they showed the blimp shot, they said flown by Captain Kerwin Silfies. It was a nice little inside nod to one of our longtime directors here in WWE. Funny little nod, I'm sure a little VKM humor, as they like to say. So Yokozuna, Savio Vega kicks things off for the tournament proper. There's no way Savio can overcome the 647-pound Yokozuna, which, let's just say, enough has been said and written about how great Yoko was, what a spectacular human specimen he was to be that size, which is enormous, like unfathomably large, yet still be able to move like a cat. How impressed were you guys by Yokozuna in this opening match?
I was more impressed not only with the opening match, we talk about, you know, the Icon special that came out on Yokozuna, to totally understand what he could do in the ring for a man his size. He kept up with Savio Vega, and yeah, it was a very entertaining opening matchup. And to your point off of the, I'm just going to call it the pre-show. The pre-show is you're sitting there going, okay, well, this was a cool run. This was a fun story. I understand Yokozuna is going to go to the second round. He's going to advance, but no, the odds were overcome. And it was a very entertaining match, and it is credit to Yokozuna for the superstar and the athlete that he truly was.
He seemed like a true threat back then. I remember as a kid, whenever one of my favorites was going against him, thinking like, man, I love, you know, wrestler X, but how are they going to beat Yokozuna? He's huge. He's such a badass. He's great.
I still to this day can't remember the exact moment, but it was later in life before I realized that Yoko was not, in fact, a Japanese sumo champion. He's a member of the prestigious Anoa'i family. I mean, one of the most powerful families, obviously head of the table, Roman Reigns. Same tribe, Yokozuna. Man, absolutely awesome. Unfortunately for Yoko, his night would end there, and we move on to a backstage, which is my favorite thread of the entire evening, my favorite story heading into this. The rivalry between Bret the Hitman Hart and Jerry Lawler had become so heated that somebody had to be humiliated into kissing the other's foot, and Jerry Lawler spent weeks leading up to this pay-per-view making absolutely absolutely sure that his feet were as disgusting as humanly possible.
I hated those updates every week. Every single Raw, you would see some vignette of Lawler like in a horse stable, just like stomping around in horse crap. And just, oh man, this is the gross, like super close-ups of Jerry Lawler's foot every single week on my television. I
loved it. Looking back now, thinking about that match that we see later in the night when he had his foot in the stable and he'd be like, Bernard's gonna have to kiss this foot. And he'd have his pant leg all rolled up to his knees and you're just like,
also, prime Jerry Lawler.
Yes, it was great.
King, for my money, never had a proper run in WWE. But obviously, if you've done any sort of homework, you know about Memphis, you know about what Jerry Lawler's done. This was, I think, the best and biggest platform for Jerry Lawler doing what he does. Still physically in his, I don't want to say still, Lawler's still physically in his prime. He's, I think he's, what, 70 now, and he still throws a perfect dropkick. It just defies all logic. But this was so much fun. And the fact that they kept throwing back to it throughout the night, it built the anticipation. You could not wait. I think everybody watching knew that Lawler was not going to win that match, but you couldn't wait to see the snarky King get his.
Also an all-timer graphic when they show the matchup screen with like Brett Lawler, and then there's like a giant, you know, foot in the middle of it.
Right.
I remember being obsessed. I think in 95, I was about eight years old. I remember being obsessed with two storylines that involved Bret Hart back in this era.
Can I guess what the other one was?
Go ahead.
Isaac Yankem.
No, it was, so obviously I was obsessed with Lawler and Bret during this time. I hated Lawler so much, and I was obsessed with finding out who was going to kiss whose foot at this event. The other was Bret and Bob Backlund, who we'll see later in this event, which was another classic early 90s feud for Bret Hart.
Yeah, no doubt about that one.
Didn't this storyline lead to Isaac Yankem? Because wasn't it like it Lawler sort of complaining about his mouth?
Because and then like, SummerSlam, yeah. I believe that year, SummerSlam 95, was Bret Hart versus Isaac Yankem, which I was present at the then Pittsburgh Civic Arena. But the Kiss My Foot match still to come. Before we get there, another tournament matchup. You got the Roadie. This is long before he was the D-O-double-G. Did not officially earned the title. I believe they make reference to the fact that he refers to himself as the Road Dog. Or
I think
somebody.
Jared calls him that once, and you can see flashes of it. He's got the dances and stuff. You can see the Road Dog in there.
Yeah, you were seeing the very first incarnations of whom we would end up knowing as the D-O-double-G. And Alex, you mentioned how the fans don't necessarily love this card top to bottom. I found myself agreeing with most of them. When the surprise sleeper matchup of the card is the Roadie versus Bob Sparkplug Holly. Maybe not the strongest card on paper in the history of the WWE, but these two were having a hell of a match.
Yeah, absolutely. Until the end.
Until the end.
I love Doc Hendricks explaining how Roadie got in there, and he goes, without a hint of irony, he beat the illustrious Doink the Clown.
Illustrious, yes.
Nothing against Matt Bourne, great wrestler, but like that's just a hilarious out-of-context sentence.
There have been, there have been many adjectives to describe Doink the Wrestling Clown. Illustrious, probably not the most apropos, but that's where PS went with it. Oh, guys, and I would be remiss to not bring it up. We've seen them by this point in the card several times. If you're wondering, yes, those two handsome young gentlemen manning the entrance doors, none other than Matt and Jeff Hardy.
Ah,
it's
that's right.
Absolutely wild to see how young and fresh-faced both of those guys were. Now they're staples, arguably one of the greatest tag teams of all time. Pulling door duty tonight at King of the Ring in 95.
They got to be 21, 22 or something at this point, right?
I refuse to believe that. I still think that Matt and Jeff Hardy are in their early 20s.
Right.
I don't know why. As long as I've known them, as long as I've been around them, I don't feel like they've ever actually truly aged.
Was it them, was it 96 when Ahmed goes running through the doors and just like knocks the two guys out of the way?
It might have been.
I think that might be the Hardys too.
I can't wait till we do an old pay-per-view with Ahmed Johnson. I love
so
Ahmed
much
Johnson.
To talk about there.
Only talks all day.
Bob Holly and the Roadie, the one thing that we want to talk about with Doc Hendricks, they saved us though from a matchup we could have had because we could have easily had Doink the Clown versus Mantar in the first round.
That is
those
true.
Two gentlemen.
I think we might be able to get an entire podcast out of that matchup.
Doink the Clown tip the cap versus, to both those superstars.
There was a Mantar sighting. There was some B-roll shown of how Bob's. Remember when he was Thurman Sparky Plug?
Mm-hmm.
My mom had a crush on him.
Did she?
He was the one wrestler back then that whenever he was on TV, my mom was always like, ooh, I like that Sparky Plug.
It was from the NASCAR vignettes, huh? When he was whipping around
in
his NASCAR.
NASCAR guy with a mullet, absolutely, yeah.
Well, he had the gear on this night. He was wearing the WWE racing team trunks.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if that was, in fact, a real thing at any
point. I believe it was for a short time.
I know later on when, like, Kofi and Randy had the story where they destroyed the race car. I know by that point the company had grown to where we did actually have some representation in the racing world. At the time of Sparky Plug, I don't know if I recall.
Well, I always believed these, like, occupational gimmicks when I was a kid, so I thought he was a real race car driver. And with the Jeff Jarrett vignettes, when it was like, oh, country star Jeff Jarrett come to WWE, I asked my mom, like, hey, you listen to country music. Did you know that Jeff Jarrett's about to be a wrestler? And she was like, who? And I was like, Jeff Jarrett, the famous country music star. You must know him.
Double J?
Yeah, he's on the cover of every magazine.
Intercontinental champion.
Yeah.
Oh, spend my time working hard on the go. You haven't heard that, Mom? Yes. Come on.
I thought it was a huge country hit.
That's fantastic.
So can we talk about the end of this match? I want to get your guys' take on what actually happened here. Was it a three count or was it not a three count?
Listen, hey, to this very day, if the shoulders aren't up, the referee's got to count to three. It was a little wonky, I'll give you that. I don't mind that once in a blue moon. To me, I sort of like when something goes awry or it's not necessarily clean because...
Cast a little doubt.
Anybody who's ever, you know, actually competed or been in a fight knows that stuff doesn't usually go according to plan.
Sometimes you kick out at 3 1/4. You know,
that's right.
It happens.
Exactly. Unfortunately, in our next match, neither man kicked out and neither man advanced. And this on paper was probably the strongest matchup of the card. Comma, WWE Hall of Famer, comma, Papa Shango, the Godfather, whatever you want to call him, versus HBK. This one had me excited because I forgot that we would not get any satisfaction out of this matchup. It goes to a draw, thus giving a bye in the next round.
Also, when the match ends, there is the most tight close-up on Sean's face, giving the most obvious completely clear.
Sean, and obvious. Not happy at all. Yes. With the outcome.
I believe a show where Vince is constantly going like, oh, it's family entertainment for everyone. Yeah. For the kids.
Except for that part.
Yeah.
Philadelphia legend Joe Frazier in attendance during this match, they made sure to point out, which was fed into our Rocky storyline, Graves.
Of course, because I don't know if you guys knew this, but it's Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the home of Rocky Balboa.
Also, this was so great because this was around the time Sean was turning babyface, I think. And, like, I always hated Sean when he was feuding with Razor, but, like, you couldn't deny how cool he was. He was the coolest guy on Raw every week. And at this point, it was, like, okay to cheer Shawn Michaels. And I thought it was so awesome seeing that. Like, okay, he's high-fiving people on the way out and everything. Like, he's a good guy now.
This is where he go. I don't know how many more months this is, but doesn't he take the enziguri from Owen Hart? Does Owen the collapse angle. He goes away. He comes back at the Royal Rumble. He wins the Rumble. Then he goes on to have the boyhood dream come true in March of the following year. So yeah,
right, that was March of 96. Yeah.
Yeah. This is right around the turn. He must have just gotten powerbombed by Sid the night after WrestleMania and then comes back with Diesel, two dudes with attitudes.
I don't know how they were able to focus with the creatures of the night in the front row.
Listen, it was some of Undertaker's more nefarious work. The creatures of the night who, clearly just left drama class and decided to sit in the front row and not enjoy WWE King of the Ring at the time.
Did they think they were going to a Cure show? Was that what they thought they were going to see the Cure, but actually
yes,
it was
yes.
WWE?
They were very disappointed when it turned out to be the Taker rather than Robert Smith.
Had Kama melted down the urn yet?
Yes. That was another storyline that was referenced on commentary multiple times that the Undertaker's still a super powerful being, but maybe not the same Undertaker as when he had the mysterious urn, which I loved because it was like, okay, if Undertaker's not going to be the total and usual badass that he normally is, it makes sense because his source of power has been compromised.
Well, so that it got compromised at the Rumble 94, famously, when all the green smoke started coming
with
out.
The casket match with Yokozuna, right?
But that was salvageable at that point, right? Was it still the same urn? You just like...
There were multiple urns. Some of them had lights in them. I remember Kama at one point melted it down into that amazing chain, which would probably cost $4 to $5 million these days if that were actual gold. The biggest gold chain in the history of gold chains, rocked by Kama Mustafa.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't it SummerSlam 94, Undertaker versus Undertaker? And that's where the new urn is unveiled because Paul Bearer gets in with the big urn and the spotlight shoots out of it and he's swarming it around. And so I think that's where the new urn came. But you know, lo and behold, almost a year later, he's still not as strong as he once was.
Well, The Undertaker would need to be at full power for his adversary on this evening. I'm talking about Mabel, one half of Men on a Mission. By this point, Men on a Mission had given up on the mission. It was no longer about the mission. It was about personal success and wealth and glory, and led to the ring by Mo, who is yet to be knighted. Mabel versus The Undertaker, two huge human beings colliding with, shockingly to everybody, Mabel picks up the W over the dead man.
Yeah, that was shocking. I don't think anyone, I mean, I think that kind of helped Mabel, obviously, because people were so shocked and so angry and so mad that this dude who was in a tag team just beat The Undertaker. Like, there's no way. But I will say, to your point, these guys won a pretty good amount of time too, going
back
and
forth. They sure did. And my big takeaway, I think, from this event was how awesome I didn't realize or remember that Mabel was. We just talked at the top of the show about Yokozuna and what a physical anomaly he was. I got to meet Mabel on several occasions around his Big Daddy V run. He was still with the company when I was being extra. And I remember he was such a cool guy. He was one of the main roster guys who always had time for me and always wanted to chat and would be standing around the ring before the show. And Mabel always, he remembered me and had come up and he always wanted to talk about tattoos. So I always liked him on a personal level. I never wouldn't consider him a friend or say I knew him, but Mabel was always really cool to me. So going back and watching this and reliving what a freak athlete he also was. Mabel is gigantic. He's had to be, what, 6'7", 6'8", easy, if not more. Well over 500 pounds. And the dude could move.
He was 6'9", by the way. I just looked it up while you're 6'9". Jeez.
Yeah, I always remembered him as a big guy, but then, like, the height I would forget about until they do the face-to-face with Taker. And it's like, holy crap, they're, like, right there.
What gets lost too with Mabel is, think about all the different characters he played. He had Mabel and Men on the Mission, then the heel Mabel single run. Then he had Viscera in the, you know, underneath the Undertaker spell and the Ministry of Darkness. Then he came back as Big Daddy V, you know, and then he came in Big Daddy V, angry with the black jumpsuit singlet. And then he came in with pajamas. I mean, this is a guy who was able to transform.
World's largest love machine.
Throughout his entire career, which is hard to do. It's very hard to do.
I agree. And I think Mabel deserves a little bit more love on his contributions. And just, if for nothing else, the athleticism he possessed and off screen, in my personal experience, being a hell of a human being, being a really great guy. And you know, there are worse things to say about somebody to their contributions than, hey, that guy was a really great guy.
And what have we learned about guys his size in this business? Longevity is not usually a strong suit. Like, guys who are that size, they usually don't have that long of a career in the business. And Mabel, as you pointed out, Vic, was able to reinvent himself so many times and stay healthy enough to have a pretty long and solid career in the WWE.
Because you're usually a one-trick pony when you're that size.
Correct.
You know, 6 foot, oh, he's strong. He's going to do it. But Kane reinvented himself. Isaac Yankum, DDS, who we talked about, all the way through his career, all the different versions of The Undertaker. It's tough to do.
And if you need to realize what a massive human being Mabel truly was, watch him execute the spinning heel kick. Because he essentially rolls across the top of his own shoulders and still kicks his opponent directly in the face. He is huge. I cannot overstate that. One of the most impressive physical specimens I've ever met in my life.
Hey, can you guys do research too, Gravy? Speaking of your spinning heel kick, I'm pretty sure Mabel threw a moonsault one time.
I don't know about that.
For some reason, I'm thinking he came off the top rope. If somebody can find that.
Well, I'm not saying Mabel never came off the top rope. I don't recall a moonsault, but we would see Big Vis head up to the high rent district later in the show. But right here, Mabel picks up the win over The Undertaker to advance in the King of the Ring tournament.
Well, with Shawn Michaels in comma, as you just said, with his Shawn Michaels BS comment, count out, both men are out. So that means Mabel goes to the
time
finals.
Time limit draw, Vic.
Time limit draw, which was 15.
15 minutes.
Yep.
15 minutes. So Mabel, by defeating The Undertaker, goes now automatically to the finals. So there's one more match to determine who is going to face Mabel, and that becomes Savio Vega and the Roadie.
Savio Vega versus the Roadie in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the hometown of Rocky Balboa.
Take a shot.
Savio Vega, with his back against the wall, faces off with JEFFJARRETT's Charge, the Roadie. I just wanted to say that. It's just too much fun. We're not talking about Jeff Jarrett. We're talking about the Roadie. And in another shocker of an upset, shocking the entire WWE universe and the city of Philadelphia, the birthplace of Rocky Balboa, Savio Vega does the unthinkable and advances again.
And now you're thinking there's no, there. It's he can't be denied. He's already defeated IRS. He defeated Yokozuna. He's defeated the Roadie. This is the night for Savio Vega, who now is going to face Mabel to be crowned King of the Ring.
Savio Vega with his sights set on Apollo Creed.
That's the thing. If you want to do the Rocky story, why Savio Mabel? Why not do Savio against Taker or Sean? Like somebody to be that Apollo. Like, okay, they're obviously going to win. They're the world champion, you know, caliber athlete. Whereas Mabel, no one expected to get that far.
Maybe, but how much fun is that though? I mean, it was, I guess in hindsight, people don't love the pay-per-view. It doesn't hold up. I honestly struggled at times to get through it. However, sometimes it's cool to just have shocking, like, I didn't see that coming. Wait. Multiple upsets in one tournament, it's no longer just the Cinderella story. There can't only be one Cinderella in March Madness. Now there are multiple. And wait a minute. What are we doing? I think the plan was here to make Mabel a monster.
I guess the logic is to make two stars out of it. You know,
correct.
Really put Savio over and you got Mabel there.
And it works because Savio beat Yoko in the earlier round. So it's like, okay, Yoko and Mabel are two huge guys. So if he's able to beat Yokozuna in the early rounds, who says he can't beat Mabel in the finals?
Also, Road Dogg, deceptively large human being.
Yeah, he looks tall here.
He's very tall. To this day, Road Dogg is a much larger than average human being. Unfortunately, the Roadie's night would end at the hands of Savio Vega. And Savio would find himself with a few moments on his hands to recover, to prepare for Mabel in the tournament finals. And while he is doing this preparation, the time has finally arrived. The Kiss My Foot match is next. Bret Hart, Jerry the King Lawler. This was, again, Jerry Lawler absolutely on fire. Plenty of Burger King chants from the Philadelphia WWE universe. This was a great match between two technicians, two of the all-time greats.
And when you think about that, we talked about those vignettes that we saw through the thread throughout the show and leading up to with the manure that Dan talked about. Tell me, guys, there was a seed of doubt planted that Bret Hart was going to kiss Jerry Lawler's foot.
Absolutely.
I mean, there was
you were a dumb child. You were a dumb child.
there was a little bit in there like, oh my God, Bret Hart.
I take offense to that, Graves. Yeah. I was worried for Bret.
Yeah, 100%
at the age of eight.
Graves is looking in hindsight, but Graves at the time was like, ooh, maybe Bret's going to kiss his foot. That'd be disgusting.
Man, I was like, that's the excellence of execution. Bret Hart's going to shut Jerry Lawler up once and for all. I knew what the outcome was going to be. I had no doubt. I had no fear. But it was definitely to me the best match on the card. Just because of the pacing and the story that they told. Two true pros. Didn't do anything too spectacular. It was nothing outrageous. It was just a very solid match.
Did they tell a story in the match?
Sure did.
Wow. And by the way, Jerry Lawler, great dropkick. Awesome right hand.
Best in the business.
Oh, best
Both
in the
them
business.
With their punches are Man. Incredible, crisp. They just look great.
Yeah, absolutely unbelievable match. I'm sorry to spoil it for you, everybody that's listening. In the event that you have not yet relived King of the Ring 1995, Jerry Lawler draws the short end of the stick. Jerry is going to be forced to kiss the foot of Bret the Hitman Hart in the wake of the Hitman locking in the sharpshooter and holding it for an extra 4 seconds. Bret didn't want to get himself disqualified, didn't want to get the decision reversed, which Doc Hendricks so eloquently pointed out. But Bret locked in the maximum suffering for the King and then gave old Jerry a face full of foot.
It was awesome. Taking off his sock, he's wiggling away and the sock's gross and it's nasty. And then you see this, and then I thought he was actually going to snap Lawler's leg, because it didn't look like Lawler bent that sort of way.
Yeah, there might have been a little extra emphasis on that sharpshooter. I know King wasn't necessarily too popular with a lot of guys that were around at that time due to some past business dealings, a bit of a reputation. But well, a so great
Lawler,
match.
Lawler kisses 2 feet here, though, doesn't he? Brett sticks his own foot, kisses, and then he kisses his own foot.
He kisses Brett's foot, and then Brett forces King to kiss his own disgusting, manure-soaked, hadn't been washed in months. I believe it was Doc Hendricks who had a line regarding Jerry's socks filing a restraining order against him because they were so foul. And of course, Jerry gets the taste of his own medicine. Your winner, Brett the Hitman Hart. This pay-per-view is worth going back and checking out just for that just match. It was just fun. It's a throwback. I don't know that it would hold up or work as well today, but it was just fun, man. Just fun to relive.
The Kiss My Foot match would grow in a few years to become a Kiss My Ass match.
It didn't grow, Vicky.
I mean, it kind of evolved, I guess you should say. Yeah, it's a Kiss My Ass match. But let's not forget the cool vignette or the cool little backstage after this. Doesn't Jerry Lawler, like, throw up in the sink?
Yeah, we are shown later in the evening, Jerry actually so physically cool. vomiting in the sink while also squeezing a tube of toothpaste down his own throat. Just
and a shattered bottle of mouthwash that he just couldn't seem to get all of it out.
Just quintessentially hokey wrestling stuff.
Excellent.
But I love that sort of stuff from time to time. In small doses, but there is nothing small about the stakes of our next match. It is that time, Vic. We are about to crown the 1995 King of the Ring in the home of Rocky Balboa, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Savio Vega versus the behemoth Mabel.
And Savio Vega now has defeated IRS, Yokozuna, the roadie. Mabel had a bye to get into this, had to defeat the Undertaker.
Fresh
Mabel. So to your point earlier about Vega having a time to breathe, he had one match. To put it that way, he had the Kiss My Foot match, and then all of a sudden he had to come right back to the ring.
Savio's up against it. This is a rough night for Savio Vega, but will he finally capture his glory? No, he won't. And honestly, it was a good match. It was not what you would imagine for the finals of the King of the Ring tournament, particularly in 2021, where it's got prestige and value and everything about the shows are different and better now, in my opinion. Particularly than they were on this night in 1995. Mabel becomes King of the Ring. And once he is adorned with his official WWE King of the Ring crown, which looked like it cost about $9 at the Halloween Adventure Store, and the robe, Sir Mo, who is knighted before God in the world on WWE pay-per-view, delivers the worst freaking speech. The coronation speech from Sir Mo regarding the brand new King Mabel took approximately 41 minutes. Sir Mo out there doing his best sports entertainment bad guy scowl, complete with inappropriate laughing in between lines. Just to show you how evil I am. And his scowl. And you can see there are several times if you look at Mabel, he's going, why are we still out here? What are we doing? He's like, I don't even think I'm king anymore. It's been that long. Mabel sits there for 29 minutes while Sir Mo coronates him as the brand new king of the WWE with a sword, which was cool even back then. I don't remember the sword. I always remember the scepter. Mm-hmm. But the sword, it looked cool. I was cool with King Mabel. I mean, he was a big monster of a human being. I dug it.
I was pissed. This is my second King of the Ring. And I remember 94, I really wanted Razor to win. And I was so mad when Owen won that one. And this one, I wanted like Shawn or Taker. And it's like, oh, man, like these King of the Rings are so fun to watch, but I was always so mad.
Dan, we are in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the home of Rocky Balboa. You wanted Savio Vega.
Rocky loses in the first one.
That's true. That is true. So maybe that's, see, here I am trying to make fun. And meanwhile, this is exactly what the intended goal was. Brand new King of the Ring. What?
Can we talk about how Mo reads from the biggest scroll I have ever seen in my entire life?
And then
to start, and this is where he loses me right at the beginning. When you think of things from this, you know, medieval times or whatever, it's always hear ye to start the speech, right? Mo delivers it as hear ye, hear ye. And right off the bat, I knew this was not going to be a good speech.
It was definitely quite a speech. I'm actually going to back it up a little bit because I took down some notes as I was watching this the other day. I actually love the ending of the matchup because I am a sucker for when guys try to hit their finishing maneuvers more than once and succeed, and that eventually wins the match. Mabel delivers this monster splash. Savio Vega kicks out at 2 9/10, and Mabel stands back up and goes, we're going to do this again. Boom, second splash. Savio kicks out at 3 1/2. And it's like, it was just overwhelming. I always talk about for my money, one of my favorite matches, Stone Cold and The Rock from WrestleMania 19, where it was three rock bottoms. Hits one on Austin, Austin kicks. Another one, somehow Austin kicks. Can you believe it? Stone Cold kicked out of two rock bottoms. There's no way Rock's going to win this. Third rock bottom, did the job. Okay, it protects the move. I just loved everything about it. It's simple to me.
One of my favorites is when somebody hits the finish, you think it's it, but like the finish, like the force of it sends them out of the ring. And it's like, oh, damn it, I can't pin him now.
Right, right. And then there was all sorts of extracurricular activity after the matchup, that being the attack from Sir Mo and King Mabel on Razor Ramon, who suffered a rib injury in the weeks leading up to King of the Ring, was not medically cleared to compete in the tournament, had his ribs taped up. It seemed as though Mabel and Mo were focused on injuring the bad guy's already injured ribs, and Mabel does the unthinkable, climbs to the middle rope. Surely he will deliver a 500-plus pound splash onto the already injured ribs of Razor Ramon. Mabel goes all just into left field with an elbow drop to the face. Maybe the stiffest looking elbow drop I've ever seen. I'm surprised it didn't crush Scott Hall's skull. Drops the elbow. Razor Ramon, he's done for. Nothing happening. Razor's been beaten down. Savio Vega coming up short in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the home of Rocky Balboa. And then the 1-2-3 kid hits the ring, trying to come to the aid of his friend Razor Ramon, and assuming he's friends with Savio Vega, he meets the same fate. Mabel and Mo take out 1-2-3 kid. Mabel intends on delivering the same fate, likely another monstrous elbow to the face of the 1-2-3 kid, but the officials break it up. Restore a little order. What I want to know is what the 1-2-3 kid had on these officials that they came to his aid after watching Razor Ramon be decimated.
I mean, I don't know why Mabel just didn't jump through all the officials. He would have squashed all of them right then and there to get to the 1-2-3 kid. Just take everybody out.
He's the king.
He's the king at this point. Who cares?
It doesn't make it's crazy to me. The injured Razor Ramon was fine to be attacked, but 1-2-3 kid who was fresh and in a very nice tracksuit.
It delivered some offense. Throwing the kicks.
That was too far.
Yeah, nope. He was in danger. The officials needed to break that up. We finally arrive at the main event of the evening. A colossal tag team matchup with Big Daddy Cool Diesel, the WWE champion, and Bam Bam Bigelow against the Million Dollar Corporation comprised of Native American Tatanka, which I notice had to be said in full anytime Tatanka was referenced. I don't think at any point they just called him Tatanka. They called him Native American Tatanka, just in case you weren't sure what his deal was. And one of my favorites of all time, Psycho Sid. But don't call him Psycho.
Oh, he said, this was fun because it's babyface Bam Bam, right? You know, it's a whole different version of Bam Bam Bigelow. Most people always remember Bam Bam Bigelow as being that rough, tough, you know, individual who is a heel, Luna Vachon. They forget that little babyface spectrum for him. And then Tatanka,
what's a babyface? What's a babyface?
He's a nice individual, Graves. He's a nice individual.
He's a hero.
I don't know if I would call Bam Bam likable.
Fan favorite.
He's a fan favorite.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The fan favorite Bam Bam Bigelow, people tend to forget. You know, they always think about Luna Vachon and whatnot and him being an evil person and mean. The fan favorite Bam Bam comes out to play. Tatanka was always interesting to me growing up because until he ran into the Million Dollar Man, he was always out there smiling. Everyone loved him and had a hell of an undefeated run that never led to any sort of championship nod. I don't even recall Tatanka ever being in the championship picture.
I believe, was Tatanka Intercontinental Champion at one point?
I don't think Tatanka ever won any title. And I don't know that. That's just me spitting. So I'm sure I'll either be told I'm wrong now or on social media. But I don't ever recall him ever winning a title in the WWE and never being in the championship picture.
So Tatanka did win one accolade in the WWE when he was there. He is a 1994 Slammy Award winner for the greediest superstar.
Bite Boom. Your tongue, Vic.
He never won a title.
Well, greediest superstar Slammy? I mean, that's arguably just you as would prestigious.
Like, but never an Intercontinental Championship, never a world title, never a tag team title. Nothing. I think that's what's wrong. He should have won some gold.
Are you implying that Tatanka didn't live up to your expectations, Vic?
Hey, when you're undefeated for that long, give the guy an opportunity.
Well, listen, here's the opportunity for Tatanka and Psycho Sid to rid the WWE of Bam Bam, of Big Daddy Cool. And this match, aside from being incredibly long, I felt like this match would never end. It was a very, very long matchup. Diesel was in full Big Daddy Cool, early beginnings of Big Sexy. The mane was flowing, just the vibe. Everything about Diesel was cool. It was not the sports entertainers that we had known and loved up to that point. It was very, very believable. He was laid back. He wasn't yelling. I really was a big fan of Diesel at the time. What stood out to me, to your point about Bam Bam Bigelow always being more known and successful as a villain, Bam Bam looked like he was still trying to figure out that flame apparatus on the way to the ring. He did his little hop, and he went to shoot the little road flares out of his hands, and it looked kind of uncomfortable. And then Bam Bam got in the ring and didn't know which direction he was going and nearly James Hetfielded himself.
That's
when
right.
The pyro in the ring actually went off. Like, I don't think anyone realizes how close to disaster we were in that instance when Bam Bam just turned the wrong way and boom, here's pyro. So, I mean, that one could have been over before it started.
Now, if I remember correctly, back to your point, Vic, about Bam Bam becoming more of a fan favorite, that's when his gear changed too, right? Because earlier, villain Bam Bam had kind of like the blue flame kind of thing yes. going on in the gear. And then as he transitioned into this more fan favorite character, that's when he went all full black with the orange and yellow.
But he looked so cool with the big jacket awesome. And the yeah. big collar
Weird
on it.
Scarf thing? Yeah, that collar with flames?
Yeah.
Yeah, he looked like the guy that spit in Newman's face in Jurassic Park with the big collar.
Yeah, the Dilophosaurus.
Yes. In my constant efforts to create an internet conspiracy or at least discussion, I think in the backstage interview with Bam Bam and Diesel in the locker room, I'm pretty sure Bam Bam Bigelow gives the world its first glimpse of what would eventually be known as Steiner math.
Yes.
The world loves Scott Steiner. Scott Steiner did it better than anybody else, but I think Bam Bam might have done it first. There is a mathematical equation that Bammers spits out before the match, explaining why he and Diesel are 220% confident, but he only added 100 and 100 or something. It was very wonky.
It's not as complex of an equation as Scott's.
Right, right. Yeah, Steiner advanced that. He took, he made it a college course. But I think the rudimentary roots of Steiner math were laid by none other than Bam Bam Bigelow, who, again, while we're talking about Mabel and what a physical specimen he is, Yokozuna, you got to throw Bam Bam into the conversation. Bam Bam, well over 400 pounds, moved like a freaking cruiserweight. Unreal human being.
It comes to Bam Bam Bigelow. You always forget about Bam Bam. Why is he not in conversations of people that should be in the WWE Hall of Fame?
I think there has been kind of a groundswell as of in recent years of getting Bam Bam in the Hall of Fame. And
I would definitely support that argument. Absolutely. Bam Bam Bigelow for WWE Hall of Fame. We actually saw the Hall of Fame earlier in the night. How weird and different did it look? They had been at the Philadelphia Marriott, and it was
the
just
brand
sort of
new
a video
Philadelphia
package.
Marriott, by the way. It had just opened.
It was brand new, but my takeaway from the Philadelphia Marriott Hall of Fame ceremony, Bill Murray inducted George the Animal Steel.
With the worst lighting ever on top of
horrible an lighting. Couldn't even see it was Bill Murray. I'm not entirely sure to this moment it was actually him. Maybe just somebody who does a great impression of him. But Bill Murray on a horse inducting George the Animal Steel. Pretty wild.
My takeaway is we need more Polish folk songs in the Hall of Fame ceremony.
Yes. Yes. Ivan Putski just cutting a rug on the stage there. What a time that was. Ultimately, after a long 17-plus minute battle, Big Daddy Cool Diesel and his partner emerge victorious, defeating the nefarious $1 Million Corporation and continuing to, I don't know.
Sid actually walked out on Tatanka at the end of this match.
Did he? I think I turned it off.
He walked right down the aisle and Tatanka got pinned, and that was the end of the pay-per-view.
I will state this. A lot of people talk about this being one of the worst WWE-produced pay-per-views when you look at online. I think it ends up leading to SummerSlam 95, which to me is a little bit worse. We can talk about that at a later date. But to me, I had a lot of fun watching this and reliving it because I enjoyed the Savio Vega story. I love the Bret Hart, Jerry Lawler thread of what they were doing because that was, again, a throwback. That wasn't just something that popped up for 6-7 months of a rivalry. That thing, that story goes back years and times from, you know, King on commentary. And then it even continued with King saying that Owen Hart was the real king of the Hart family. And it played so well into this night. And you were right, Graves. This night was about building new stars. Mabel, Savio Vega, to push forward the new generation of the WWE. So I don't think it was as bad as people give it credit to be. I think it leads to SummerSlam, which again, to me, is one of the worst pay-per-views of all time, in my opinion. So I give a lot of credit to this night. It's one that, again, I do remember very fondly.
I think ultimately it's a fun little time capsule, much like when we look back at Fall Brawl 1995. I don't know why we've chosen 1995. Seems like a banner year for not great sports entertainment.
But this is actually the kids.
Yeah, we're all kids. We were kids.
And this is actually the 95th episode of After the Bell, so maybe that has something to do
with it. Wow, look at that. Cheers. Weird happenstance. Absolutely crazy. It was a fun trip down memory lane, even if it wasn't spectacular from an action standpoint. It was just a cool little time capsule and the characters, and just it's worth going back and watching it for no other reason than to appreciate how far we've come. It felt almost prehistoric. The pyro just looked so cheap in the entranceway, and it just it was a different time, and it was prior to the Attitude Era and the business booming and WWE becoming a global powerhouse. It's just kind of nice to remember your roots from time to time and look back at some of the characters that we remember from our childhood.
And even stuff that is hokey as hell now, like the Kiss My Foot match, I remember being 9-10 years old in my living room and just cheering my ass off because like Lawler was getting his and he was throwing up and just laughing so hard at that. Like, you know, it was a more innocent time and we were more easily entertained by things like that, I think.
And Dan was walking around asking his mom, how come you don't know who Jeff Jarrett is? Where's the cassette tape, Mom? Like, he didn't know.
He's a megastar.
I agree with you, Dan, actually. Like, this event does not encompass any of the things that I would grow to really truly love about sports entertainment, like into my older years. But I look back on it so fondly because I remember being such like a naive kid and how much this simple stuff, like the Kiss My Foot match and the rivalry between Bret Hart and Jerry Lawler just entertained me so much. It was so much fun. Really quick footnote before we wrap this up. So I talked earlier about the significance of the Spectrum. There was another historical significance in this event, which was this is apparently, according to lore, the event where Vince became first aware of a little company in Philadelphia called ECW. Now, if you remember, if we go back to Mabel versus Savio in the finals of the King of the Ring, you heard some ECW chants during that match. There was a moment where someone in the aisleway held up an ECW t-shirt as someone's walking down to the ring. And also, the two most famous audience members in all of ECW, the two guys with the Hawaiian shirts that are always front row at the ECW arena, were front row right on hard cam for King of the Ring 95. So this event, according to lore, is what made Vince become aware of the company and eventually, which would lead to, in later years, the ECW invasion that we saw on Monday Night Raw.
Interesting little factoid. I mean, you weren't but a close enough to throw a rock from the corner of Swanson and Rittner in South Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We all know how that worked out. Before we shut this thing down, before we move on, I have to know, we saw some of the best hair in WWE history throughout the course of the night. I mean, we've got the Roadies braids, and they were long and I believe blonde, and they were just outrageous at the time. Savio Vega, really a front runner here by shaving his initials into the back of his head. We've got Diesel's beautiful flowing locks we mentioned earlier. Mabel and Mo, a couple of unique Mohawks. I have to give the nod to the Supreme Fighting Machine, Kama Mustafa, because to walk around with that hairdo, you had to be a badass. That's how you knew not to mess with Kama. Anyone that would willingly cut their hair in that manner will probably eat you alive. So don't mess with Kama. I'm taking it around the horn. Dan, who had the best hair in King of the Ring 1995?
I'm going to go with the dark horse. I'm going to go with Waltman because back then I was inspired to try to grow my hair out because I wanted to look like the 1-2-3 kid in sixth grade.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, now you guys have the same, not much on top and a
down
nice
here,
beard.
Really.
Nice.
Yeah.
You eventually got there, Dan.
Yeah, half of it, yeah.
What about you, Alex?
I got to go with something that attracted Dan's mother so much, which was the Bob Sparkplug Holly flowing locks. My goodness, he just looked really, really fresh out of 1995. The long mullet was certainly popular back then, and Bob, I think, pulled it off the best on the show.
Vic?
I'm going to go with the roadie with the braids. I thought that was awesome to see when it's all done up there and whatnot. I give the nod to old Road Dogg.
And we have to give an honorable mention to that mullet being rocked by HBK. God dang, that thing was fierce at the time. Inspired today's kid. Isn't it weird? Mullets are kind of a thing now. My son made me take him to the barbershop to get a mullet. It's back.
And let's not forget the mullet. He also had a little bit of a beard. A full beard had grown in, I think.
Stubble Sean going on.
King of the Ring, the stubble. So he had a whole fresh face
stubble
of hair.
Stubble Sean.
And we're talking about mullets and nostalgia and going back to 1995, talking about the King of the Ring. I'd be wrong if I didn't remind everybody that this upcoming Tuesday, October the 26th, on the USA Network, Halloween Havoc, one of my favorite WCW pay-per-views of the past. So honored to be part of the first one in WWE history. It'll happen this Tuesday. NXT Halloween Havoc. Cannot wait to get there.
Well, we want to know what you, the ATB faithful, think. Who had the best hair of King of the Ring 1995? Pull it up. Peacock, WWE Network. Check it out. It's worth reliving, if for only to laugh at for your own entertainment. Let us know who you think wins the competition. Use the hashtag AfterTheBell. Make sure you follow us at AfterTheBellWWE on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find me at WWE Graves. You can find him at VicJosephWWE. Listen for free on Spotify. Just search After the Bell. Hit the follow button so you never miss an episode. We'll be back next week with more wisdom, more vitriol, and more WWE After the Bell.